abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, February 11th, 2014. Public goods are often cited to justify government intervention. You'll see this economic concept in your introductory economics course and in every economics textbook. But does it, in fact, justify government intervention? We're going to look at that question today with Professor Fred Folvery, author of Public Goods and Private Communities, The Market Provision of Social Services. But before we get to Fred, a couple of quick notes here. Do you believe that next week, I can't believe this, next week, a week from today, is our 100th show? I cannot believe I've done 100 shows already. Where'd the time go? Well, thanks everybody so much for supporting the show all this time, for subscribing on iTunes and Stitcher, for spreading the word about the show, for linking to the show, letting your friends know about it. I really, really appreciate that. And for the 100th episode, I'm trying to arrange for a special guest. It's not Ron Paul, by the way. We've had Ron Paul as a guest already. I'm sure I'll have him on again in the future. But I want to have somebody I haven't had yet. So I'm arranging that. I don't know if it's going to work out. I should be able to give you guys a definitive answer in a couple of days. But I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy episode number 100. Also, I've got a blog over at tomwoods.com. This program is archived at tomwoodsradio.com. And in fact, we stream the program for the first time every day, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern, at tomwoodsradio.com. But I have my own site, tomwoods.com, with a blog. And just the other day, I posted a brand new video that I made and my letter to the president of Loyola University, New Orleans, because they're giving Walter Block a hard time again. This time because of the New York Times attack. They're treating him absurdly. They're treating him in a way they would never treat a left-wing professor who had been accorded similar treatment by the Times. And I eviscerate these people. The other night I was sitting there watching the Olympics. And by the way, I love the Olympics. I know I'm not supposed to because the Olympics is nationalistic, whatever. But you know what? Forget ideology once in a while. Just live. Just enjoy life. And I like the Olympics. I like watching people compete in events that if I had 58 lifetimes, I couldn't possibly master. I love that. But the other night, I couldn't enjoy it. I was sitting there fuming because I had made this video in support of Walter, but that just wasn't enough. So I sat down and wrote an open letter, basically, to the president of Loyola University. I just banged it out in no time at all. And I am so happy with this thing, with how well it came out. I really want you guys to check it out at tomwoods.com on the blog. And then you can also check out my special page to help out Walter yourself at tomwoods.com/Walter. But really, you got to look at the blog at tomwoods.com and read that letter. You're really going to like it. And the thing is that making a YouTube is more time-consuming than you think it is. And I just didn't have time. I don't have time to do any of these things anymore because of the Ron Paul homeschool program that I'm spending so much time creating courses for. I'm doing 3.5 courses. It's 180 video lessons per course. This is draining all the life and all the time out of me. But I made special time to do this for Walter because he just doesn't deserve this. He doesn't deserve it. You got to read that letter. Please, please, please read that letter. And then finally, just to see how raw this program can be, I'm sure some of you noticed last week that an error in the program crept out there when iTunes and Stitcher sucked the program away from us as a podcast. You were able to hear an error that I should have fixed. And I had made a notation to myself, and then I wasn't able to read my writing. And so the error was not fixed. I am my own audio engineer on this program, by the way. And so when Peter Klein and I were talking about Marxism, Peter was saying, you know, and my second point is, Now, what was my second point? And I'm assuring you, well, don't worry, we'll edit this out. And then that actually got out there to you guys. So, you know, look, nobody's perfect, right? Something like that is bound to happen. And now if you were to download that episode right from the archive at TomWoodsRadio.com, you'll find that error is gone. It has been smoothly removed, just like something out of a George Orwell novel, right? Like, that error never even existed. It's gone. All right, that's enough of that. Enough chit-chat. Stay tuned after my discussion with Fred Foldry for a sneak preview of what's coming up this week. Wait till you hear what we've got in store for you on the program tomorrow for Lincoln's birthday. But right now, I'm very glad to welcome to the program Fred Foldry. Fred is a research fellow at the Independent Institute, so he's the second fellow at the Independent Institute in a row we've had on this program. That's entirely coincidental. Independent.org is their website. He's a lecturer of economics at San Jose State University, and over the course of his career has taught at half a dozen universities. The book of his I want to talk about today is Public Goods and Private Communities, The Market Provision of Social Services. Fred Foldry, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
Now, the subject of public goods is a perennial topic, of course, because anybody taking an introductory economics course is going to find this concept in a textbook or in a government textbook. Public goods are a very, very common rationale for government intervention. But before we go into specific examples of public goods, I wonder if you might just explain to people what this concept means, because it has a specific technical meaning in the economics literature that the lay audience might not be familiar with.
That's right. Unfortunately, the word public has two distinct different meanings in economics. One is people in general, like something is open to the public. The other meaning is government, as in public schools, right? A public school is a government-operated school, not a school open to the general public. Now, public goods has the first meaning of collective goods, goods which a number of people use at the same time, and they are non-rival in that the use by one person does not reduce the use by another person. For example, if there are several people in a room, the lighting in the room is used by all of them. One more person in the room is not going to reduce the amount of lighting that they have. So that's what a collective good means, and that's what public goods mean.
And also there's a non-excludability aspect to public goods.
Yeah, if you look at textbooks, they have two criteria. One is that it's non-rival, and the second one is non-excludable. But then when they actually talk about government providing public goods, almost everything that they mention is excludable. For example, highways are excludable in that you can remove a car from a highway. Policemen do that when they stop a car. Streets, security, fire protection, all of those things are excludable. So if non-excludable is a rationale for government provision, then there's no rationale with respect to public goods. So, and also the economist Paul Samuelson wrote a very famous article on public goods in 1954, in which he had two categories, private goods, which are individually used, public goods, which are used by a group of people at the same time, without the non-excludable feature. Now, and then economists talk about local public goods, which are necessarily excludable because they apply to the locality.
Now, what about something
now,
like,
if you want to include, if you insist on public goods being non-excludable, then there's hardly any public goods other than gravity.
Okay. Well, what about something like education? It's interesting that that would be considered a public good. The only reason I could see that education would be considered a public good is if you think in terms of externality and spillover effects, the claim being that we all benefit from an educated public, and therefore, because I don't have to pay for an educated public, the market will underproduce education. But education certainly is excludable.
Yeah, and there is indeed a positive externality, right? But it is excludable also. So the rationale for government-funded education is the positive externality, right?
Right. And I guess I should explain to people when we say non-excludable, I mean, I guess most people probably figured this out, but we just mean that there's no way, like if there's a fireworks display going on somewhere, it's not, you know, I can view it from my balcony. I can, you know, there
right.
It would be basically impossible to exclude me from it. But yet there are a great many of cases, as you say, when you look at the empirical examples of public goods that it seems like if you were trying, you could exclude people from. So what do you think? Is it these criteria, the excludability, the rivalrousness, is it these that are flawed and that makes the whole concept flawed? Or are there other problems with the public goods concept?
The main problem with the conventional public goods concept is that economists treat public goods as if it was out in the ether, out, you know, in the sky, or, you know, there's no physical time and place, right? Once you put public goods like a public transit or a park or streets in a physical time and place, then you realize that these goods are mostly territorial. They impact the territory and generate land rent. So if a private organization can collect the land rent, then it can be paid for through the market. Secondly, the conventional treatment saying that government has to step in to provide it overlooks the fact that in the market you can have private governance, as you do with homeowner associations, condominiums, land trusts, and other private or shopping centers, proprietary communities. So the market contains governance. It's just that it's contractual governance. And so, therefore, when they say you need government, what they really should say is you need some kind of governance, yes, to manage things. But there is governance in the market by contract.
So, in other words, one of the key problems here is that public goods theorists just jump to the conclusion, or perhaps they've reached the conclusion in advance, and it's a conclusion in search of a theory. I don't know, but it seems that they automatically assume government provision, the necessity of government provision. And you're saying that assumption is not necessary. Now, in your book, you go on to give specific examples. You've got about five case studies in this book where you talk about private communities and how they've dealt with the public goods question. Now, this book is from over 20 years ago. Right. Obviously, Walt Disney World is still alive and kicking, but are the other examples still live ones today?
Yeah. All the other examples are still there. I have a condominium association in Virginia, which is still there. A residential association, Reston, with a population of about 70,000, that's still operating. Of course, Walt Disney World is still there. And then I have private neighborhoods in St. Louis, where the neighborhood can privatize the street and manage it. That still exists. So everything is still still existing.
All right, so maybe you could pick one of these to get us started that might be especially illustrative or the best or strongest example, but give us a sense of maybe a short list of the sorts of goods that everybody just takes for granted have to be funded through tax revenues that, in fact, in these private communities, people have managed to fund through means that are not coercive.
Yeah, one example is a village in Delaware called Arden. It's a village of a population of about 500 people. And so it was founded in 1900. And so it's still continuing along the same lines. You know, a lot of intentional communities eventually fail because they overlook human nature and things. So, but this has survived. So a land trust owns the land, and people lease land from the trust. But then the first settlers erected their own building. So a homeowner there owns the building and leases the land. The rent payments enable the trust to pay the expenses of the government, it has municipalized due to government interventions that make it costly to have a purely private community because they save on taxes if they can municipalize. So it is a municipality. However, the funding is private. People pay rent to the trust. The trust pays the finances of the community and the government's property tax because the property tax is both on the land and the buildings, and the founders only wanted to have payments based on the land so that there'd be no penalty to improving your property. And so that's an example of the economics of private communities. They all, in a sense, do that. The clearest case is the land trust, where people pay rent for the use of land, that rent finances the collective goods of the community. About half of Arden is forest and open land, so they have preserved a lot of the nature there on their own. But if you look at a typical condominium association, it operates on the same principles, just not so clearly. You have unit owners who pay an assessment to the condominium association in exchange for getting collective goods through what's called the common elements, like parking, landscaping, security, and so on. And it's all done by a contract among co-owners. So there's private governance in this condominium association. The same thing applies to residential associations. And then also proprietary communities like a shopping center. There you'd have one landlord and tenants who pay rent, and that rent pays for the expenses of the shopping center. So all of these basically show the economics of contractual communities financed by assessments on the members or tenants.
So would the idea then be that the private providers of these so-called public goods would more or less be competing against one another to get the contracts to provide mm-hmm. the services to this community or that community? So you have some type of competition going on, and then ultimately each community will decide upon a provider for a particular mm-hmm. service?
Yeah, hotels offer a good example. It's a prototype of the private community. There are, many hotels, so they compete with one another. And they provide collective goods, such as public transit in the form of elevators and escalators. They have a lobby, which serves as the park. They got corridors. They got, various recreational services and so on. So many of these are provided at no extra charge. Right, so you don't pay to use the elevator; it's paid for out of your room charge, right? So that's a tie-in between the collective good of the transit and your individual good of your hotel room, and you're willing to pay more for the hotel room, or you have more collective services. You wouldn't pay very much for a room if you had to walk up three or four levels of stairs.
Right. Now, what would you say though to people? I'm sure who would pretend not to see a difference between the types of communities you're describing and local governments. They would, I'm sure, think that if you're paying a fee in exchange for getting some collective good, isn't that really just government all over again? What's the mistake in that thinking?
Well, if you look at proprietary communities where you have a single owner, even if it's a corporation, nobody says that a guest in a hotel room is paying to a government. The hotel administration is commonly recognized as private. Same thing with shopping centers and so on. But when it comes to community associations, like a residential association, then there's a very strong similarity in form, because like people in a town elect a city council, people in a condominium association elect a board of directors. The public goods they provide are quite similar. They provide security, parks, and so on, parking, right? But so there's two essential differences. One is that with a community association, there's an explicit contract. When you join a housing association, homeowners association, condominium, or whatever, you are presented with the master deed and the bylaws, and here's how we make payments. And you sign, right? Now, it's a very important principle in real estate law that contracts for important things like real estate have to be signed. If it's not signed, then the law does not recognize it as a contract, right? And so there's an explicit contract, which means real agreement. Some people think, well, if I live in a state like California, I could move out if I wanted to, so I kind of agree to all the laws. But there's no real agreement. I have not signed anything that I agree with all the policies. So with a contractual community, there's a signed contract, which indicates real agreement. Secondly, everybody in a private association is equal in legal terms. That's not true for government. In government, the officials have sovereign immunity. They cannot be sued without their consent in the performance of their duties. But with a condominium association, if somebody on the board of directors or if the whole board of directors violates the bylaws, you can sue them in court, and you have equal status. They don't have sovereign immunity. So I think those are two very important differences, which I think turns the private community into a contractual association that is within the market, just like any other contract.
Let's talk for a minute about security, about police protection, and how that would be provided in these kinds of situations, because I think it's not difficult for people to imagine how in a community, just as in a shopping mall or an amusement park, you could contract out for basic security services to some firm. But then when I have multiple communities and there could be a case where a criminal has run from one jurisdiction to another, then how do we bring about, I don't think it would be a big problem, but I could imagine a skeptic wondering, how would you bring about cooperation among the different firms who are providing security services in different areas?
You would have a broader area association. You would have an association of associations. So the private communities in a neighborhood would link up together and create a higher level association. They would send representatives to a council that represents all of these communities. And so there would be agreements for mutual aid, you know, cross-border help in the case of, pursuing a criminal and so on. And they would also coordinate. There would be higher-level public goods that require, you know, a greater scope than just the local community, like, say, pollution control or a major highway or mosquito control, things like that. They require a broader area. You would have this higher-level association that would provide these collective goods as well as coordinate among the communities. And to some extent, this is already being done by some private communities. And by the way, there's an institute that serves homeowners associations, Community Associations Institute, I think it's called, in Virginia. So they've already organized somewhat to further mutual aid.
Is there any kind of legal obstacle that might exist at any level of government to the establishment of purely private communities? Like, would the government say, look, you have to take our services, or you can't exclude us and contract out to somebody else. We're going to provide the services, and we're going to tax you for them. Is there any legal obstacle, or is it just an ideological obstacle right now where people just either aren't aware of this option or they have a prejudice against it?
Oh, there are definitely legal obstacles. You can't just go in and convert a neighborhood into a private association in most places. There's one place that you can do that, and that is St. Louis, which is one of the chapters of the book, The Private Places of St. Louis. There, going back to the mid-1800s, you could privatize a community, and you can still do that. But in almost all other places, you can't just say, well, we're going to convert our neighborhood into privately owned streets and pay for our own maintenance. Secondly, even in St. Louis, where you can do that, the homeowner still pays the same taxes if the neighborhood is privatized as when it's operated by government. So there's a financial disincentive. If you could take a tax deduction for the expenses you save the government and have the legal ability to privatize, there would be a lot more of it than there is a lot more of it. Today, what the government does in most places is a new development can have a homeowners association, but you can't take an existing neighborhood and turn it into a homeowners association.
Now, in your book, I think you make a pretty good case that the private sector can handle the provision of a lot of goods that people have assumed that it can't. But beyond that, the question would arise, why should the private sector do this? I mean, what would be the improvement? Why would it be desirable to have the private sector do it? If it ain't broke, don't fix it, people would say. And I bet a lot of people think it's really not that broke.
Well, the whole economy is broke. We have high unemployment. We have poverty. We have pollution. We have many. We have traffic congestion, so it is broke. The whole system is quite broke. A private provision of collective goods would just be a lot more efficient. There's a waste in taxation and subsidies, which economists call a deadweight loss. and the deadweight loss is quite large relative to, you know, the economy. The deadweight loss is almost as big as the taxes paid. That's, you know, think of the cost of filling out income tax forms, millions and millions of people spending many hours filling out income tax forms, or the fact that a sales tax makes a good more expensive, so less is produced than if there were no tax on it. So the financing of collective goods by government with current taxes is very wasteful. It creates a loss, you know, beyond what you pay in taxes in money. It creates less production, less growth, and so on. So private provision, you know, is going to be more efficient because, for example, a hotel is not going to, when they charge for a room, they're not going to say, well, how much income do you have? We're going to base the room charge on income. People would say, well, this is none of your business. I just want to pay for the room, right? They would not impose a sales tax on the shops in a hotel because that just makes it more expensive to do business. So private communities have and they compete in the market with one another. They want to attract residents and customers. They have an incentive to act in the most efficient way possible. So the assessment paid to a condominium association is a charge that essentially is based on the location value of your unit. It has no relationship to your personal income, to your personal spending, and to the personal goods that you have in your unit. So there's no disincentive to be more productive, to buy more stuff, or to accumulate more goods.
One more question, if I may. I can understand, and I think even people who are new to these ideas could understand, how roads might be administered in a community. Doesn't seem like an insuperable obstacle, really. But then how would you conceive of how a highway system might work? Because that would exist outside the context of these private communities that you're envisioning.
Well, there's two sources of funding for a major highway. One is tolls, and there are all over the world toll highways where people pay periodically. And in fact, like where I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, the bridges are owned by the government, but to cross it, you pay a toll. So tolls would be one way, and the ideal toll is just high enough to prevent congestion. And the second way to finance a highway is the highway will increase the economy of those places served. And so, again, this highway could be funded or provided by an association of communities, right? And so they would pay some of the cost because they get a benefit. The highway increases the business and the land value, right, and the rental value of land in those areas. So they would pay some of that back to the highway provider. So a combination of tolls and community assessments would be ample financing for these highways.
And I think on a smaller scale, there are a lot of public goods that could be provided especially easily in the age of the internet, where there are all these different means of raising money for different causes, and that basically everybody knows about these means, and everybody's has a vested interest in following the progress of it and how much money's been raised, and people's names can be put up. This person gave this much, that person. So there's a way of, well, I don't know, maybe applying a little social pressure to get everybody to try and chip in, but it seems like there are options now that we couldn't have dreamed of 20 years ago.
That's right, and also the internet provides people with information. That people can now get information about a particular community or a particular project or so on, where it would have been difficult to obtain that information previously. Of consumer protection and so on, reviews, product reviews, all these things are now much more available.
Fred, if people would like to follow your work and find out more about you, how can they do that online most easily?
Well, my website is www.fulbright.net, and I'm on Facebook also. And the book that you were referring to, Public Goods and Private Communities, is found in many libraries, or you can order it from Edward Elgar Publishing.
All right, and we will put links to these things in the show notes for this episode. So, Fred, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much. It's a very important topic, and you handle it very, very well. I'm glad to have had a chance to talk to you.
You're welcome.
All right, everybody, that's the program for today. Tomorrow, on Lincoln's birthday, we will be joined by Tom DiLorenzo himself, author of The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked, among many other books. This is going to be fantastic. You're not going to want to miss it. Tom DiLorenzo on Lincoln's birthday. Then on Thursday, Bob Murphy will join us. We're going to be talking about the economic policies that millennials, so-called, are being told they need to embrace and support. What they forgot to mention is that, yeah, they should embrace and support these policies if they hate themselves. So Bob and I are going to go through those one at a time with you guys. And then Friday, we're going to return to the president shtick in advance of President's Day with historian Bert Folsom, the author of New Deal or Raw Deal, which is a fantastic book on the domestic policy of Franklin Roosevelt. And then finally, remember, you can learn the history and economics you did not get in school because they didn't dare share the real thing with you at MyLibertyClassroom.com in courses taught by me and by people I trust that you can download, listen to in your car, or you can watch the video version on your mobile device or whatever. Plus, Q&A forums for a year, get all your questions answered. And as a listener of this program, you get a special discount with coupon code SHOW in all caps. That's LibertyClassroom.com. Check that out. Thanks so much for listening today. Tom DiLorenzo tomorrow. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.